Okay. There we go. Sorry. Just waiting. Okay. Hi, everybody. I know that, or I just noticed that officially the classes for the Tel Aviv International Synagogue are on hold for Chol HaMoed. But I prepared something for today, and I just found out that things were on hold. So you can't really, one shouldn't really, has a good class ready, hold it back and not share it. So those of you who are around, Vakasha, those who you're not around, I'll put this up and you can listen to this as you wish. I have another reason, more personal and more intense reason for wanting to speak this afternoon for my usual half hour. And that is for the simple reason that a very dear friend passed away over the Chag, a person who left a deep and abiding impact, impression on me, on everyone who knew. There was not anybody I knew that didn't love him. I'm speaking of my friend, Rabbi Ronen Neuwirth, who passed away at the really tender age of 50, with so much, having achieved so much in his life, having founded the Beit Hillel organization, having served in so many capacities around the world just for the advance of the Jewish people and for Torah. Even though you're not supposed to say a, you know, one doesn't offer eulogies on the on during the intermediate days of a festival, this will not be a eulogy, but I'd like to dedicate it to his to his memory, and hopefully something about him will emerge, or you'll have it. Those of you who didn't have the privilege of knowing him, something about him will emerge from the comment. All right, there is a long discussion of the fact that there's a duality about matzah that appears from the Torah itself, and certainly certainly continues throughout all of the commentaries on the Haggadah, and in one's own in our own experience of the Seder and afterwards. On the one hand, the matzah is termed lechem oni, the bread of affliction, which our ancestors ate in Egypt. That's what the Torah says very clearly. On the that's one reason, and so that's one reason that we eat the matzah is because to remember our servitude in Egypt. On the other hand, the Torah also says that we're supposed to eat matzah during Pesach because we left Egypt in haste and there wasn't time to let the bread rise. And the haste of us taking advantage of the moment and leaving Egypt with bread that was half risen, which did not had to have a time to ferment. That's what chametz really means, some kind of a process of fermentation. We remember our redemption through the matzah. In other words, so matzah has a, has a, has two at least two at least two characteristics. One is that it invokes slavery. On the other hand, that it invokes invokes redemption. So the two don't go together. You can eat, you can't be both redeemed and a slave. It's an oxymoron. So which is it? In an attempt to be able to parse this conundrum, the commentaries offer many, many different paths and many different options. One of them is projected and presented and offered by Rabbi Lo of Prague, the Maharal, who's more famous for his golem than he was for his matzahs, but still, in his commentary on the Haggadah, which appears at the end of his book, excuse me, the Gevurat Hashem, he offers one explanation, which then he rejects, and then he offers his own. The truth of the matter is that, with all due respect to the Maharal, I think that both are true, and we'll see in a minute why. He says that he quotes anonymous sources. I've not been able to find out exactly who he's quoting here. He says that the reason why that the matzah was the bread of affliction is because matzah, as we have all discovered, as we have all discovered, has a tendency to be something on the heavy side. It stays with you, how should we put it? It stays with you for a long time. It is the culinary equivalent of what's called watering a camel. In other words, you water a camel and the camel can go out in the desert 3, 4 days, doesn't need any more water. So the same thing is true with matzah. If you eat a lot of matzah, it will stay with you for a number of days. And I can see everybody laughing and smiling because we all know exactly what that means. The point of this interpretation is that the Egyptians would feed the Israelites matzah because they didn't want to feed them all that much. They wanted that maximum amount of work out of them. So as a result, they fed the matzah. The matzah kept them going. They didn't have to be fed so often, and they could just keep working. That's the explanation that is cited by the Maharal in his commentary. The Maharal himself doesn't like it. He's really not happy with it because he says we don't have any sources for the fact that the Jews ate matzah when they were in Egypt. Just aren't. On the contrary, when the later on when the Israelites idealize their time in Egypt, and they sit there and say, oh boy, we remember all this great food we used to have there. We used to eat like kings. We used to have cucumbers and watermelons and all kinds of onions, and we just ate like, it was like phenomenal. I mean, we were foodies on steroids when we were slaves in Egypt, as opposed to this manna that God keeps giving us, which is sort of like soya, because yeah, you can turn it into anything you want, but it's still the same white lump in a container. It's not, you know, that's, we want to eat. These, we were talking about Jews, you know, they want to eat. So. And that was the complaint. So says the Maharal, he said, we don't have, so that's what they ate. They really got food. They got fish. Whatever they wanted to have, they could have. We have no indication, no, there's no literary indication, says the Maharal, of the Egyptians eating or afflicting the Jews, or the afflicting the Israelites with manna. So says the Maharal. Says, so why is matzah called the bread of affliction? And how can it become the bread of redemption? So he says that lechem oni doesn't mean bread of affliction. It means basic bread. It means bread which really has no additives, no anything. It's simply flour and water, which is what matzah is, as opposed to what he calls matzah ashira, rich matzah, elaborate matzah, invested matzah. What's matzah ashira? Matzah ashira is also matzah. It's matzah which is not chametz, but which contains wine or honey or eggs, what we would call egg matzah. Among Ashkenazim, among Sephardim, it's called matzah ashira. Interestingly, Ashkenazim don't eat it, and Sephardim do. So the contrast is actually more available, more obvious when it comes to Mizrachim and not Ashkenazim. He says, "Well, what's the difference between matzah shira and this basic matzah?" And that is that when you eat matzah shira, he says, when you have extra ingredients, you end up the culinary experience of eating matzah shira is dependent upon a plethora of ingredients which are added to the basic flour and water. And your experience depends on the additives. He says, when it comes to matzah, it's what you see is what you get. In other words, the entire existence of matzah is totally self-sufficient. That's what it is. I mean, it's water and there's nothing, it can be nothing more basic than water and flour. What do we derive from this according to the Maharal? The Maharal says that is the difference between slavery and freedom. A slave is dependent. A slave has no life of his own. A slave has no sense of time. One of the things, it's interesting, the first mitzvah in the Torah, when it's a little bit odd, one wouldn't have expected it. The first mitzvah in the Torah is the commandment to sanctify to set up a calendar. Because only free people have calendar. We have time. We have a sense that there's a past, there's a present, and more importantly, there's a future. For the slave, life is one long grind. Day and night, they merge into each other. There's nothing. It's endless. It's hopeless. A person who has time can organize his time. He is a owner of his time. He can arrange his time and dedicate his time as he wishes. And he can go to sleep when he wants. He can get up when he wants. That's freedom. So time is a very precious thing. So, you know, a slave is dependent upon the master for what he does. He has no, his time is somebody else's, his body is somebody else's, his life is somebody else's. Matzah symbolizes redemption. Matzah symbolizes the fact that you are what you are. You are not dependent on anything. You are dependent, what you have is your basics, you, and your existence doesn't depend on added ingredients, which are found in Matzah Shira. So that is that's the Maharal's objection. That's his alternative interpretation. Now, I frankly think that there's not that much of a contradiction between the two, because as I think I hinted at before, the exact same interpretation. Let's assume for a minute that the Israelites did receive matzah in when they were slaves, and that matzah was used by the enslavers, by the Egyptians, to guarantee the maximum amount of work and the minimum amount of investment in feeding the slaves. But when you think about it for a minute, under circumstances of freedom, the same biological or the same culinary function, the same advantage that matzah provides can be used for a free person. In other words, when they're leaving Egypt, they eat matzah. And they eat matzah, and for the next few days, they're not going to have anything. They can maximize their efforts to get out of slavery. In other words, the exact same thing, the exact same item, the exact same piece of food, which was emblematic of the exploitation of a human being and the dependence of the human being, also can be used to enable the human being to enable the slave who has now been liberated to get out and to go out on his own and to maximize his own efforts on his own behalf. What's the difference? The difference is attitude. The difference is circumstance. You can take, one can actually take the bread of affliction, which leaves one in one place, and you're enslaved to the other person. And when you're on your own, you can experience that ability to just get ahead and go without being dependent on anybody else feeding you as a sign of freedom. The difference is your circumstances. The difference is your attitude. That's part of what happens during the Seder. Halach ma'anya, this is the bread of affliction, of our enslavement, is transformed by reliving the process of redemption into the bread of redemption. It's how you look at it. There's a famous, you want to call it half full, half empty, that would be fine. There's a famous story about the Baal Shem Tov that recounts that he met the water carrier in the town of Medjugorje, where he lived. And he asked him, "How are you?" And the water carrier said to him, "What am I? I'm the water. I'm the Wasserträger. I'm the guy that schleps the water. I mean, I'm the lowest of the low. I nobody gives me any. I have no respect. They take advantage of me. They scream at me." If those of you who know Rudyard Kipling's poem Gunga Din about the Indian water carrier who served the British troops, the British Imperial troops in India, it's the worst of the worst is to be a water carrier, and I have no honor, I have no respect. It's a horrible life. The Baal Shem Tov tried to reassure him and so on, but the water carrier didn't want to hear it. And then on another occasion, the Baal Shem Tov met the same water carrier. He said, "How are you doing?" He says, "Oh, thank God, Baruch Hashem. I have the best job in the world, because there's nobody in the world that doesn't need water. Everybody needs my services. I'm the top of the heap. I see all these guys who sit there and sell stuff, and they've got all kinds of luxury items that they sell in their stores, and sometimes they make a sale, and sometimes they don't make a sale, but I am absolutely always in request. They always request me. I'm always in demand, and my life is phenomenal." Now, he had the same job. It didn't matter. But the difference is your attitude. So matzah can either be the bread of affliction or can be the bread of redemption, fueling the redemption to get out of where you need to be. The same thing with regard, by the way, of, and then you coming, if that being the case, that once you make that switch, you understand what the Maharal was saying. He's saying that once you take that same thing that was used for your enslavement, meaning matzah, and you say, "This is for me. I don't need anybody else." In other words, I'm not dependent on someone else. I'm my own person. I'm an individual, and I really am an individual. This is not Monty Python. I'm an individual, and I'm not, right? Once you do that, then anything can become an act of redemption. Once you're your own person, Once the matzah, the essential matzah, is, then you can go and enlist other ingredients and make matzah shira. But the base has got to remain me. When I as an individual, when I as a person who has my own ideas and my own sense of self and my own vision and so on, then I can enlist the honey and the eggs and everything else to make a larger and a much more elaborate and a richer matzah shira, a richer dish. But I should never lose sight of the fact that at the base, every single person is flour and water. Every single person is their person. The mixture of different people enriches humanity as long as each individual maintains their humanity and maintains their own individuality. And then the group of individuals melds into something which is larger than the sum of its parts. And that's actually the nature of Pesach. The nature of Pesach is that on the one hand, it's a bunch of individual Jews who are will sacrifice or offer or celebrate the Seder, but they do so in joining together as a people where the total is larger than the sum of its parts. That's the nature of the Jewish people, which transcends the individual. Halach ma'anya diachalu avatana barad mitzrayim. This was the bread of affliction of our ancestors ate in Egypt. Kol dichvin yetevi echol, kol ditzrich v'yetevi evsach. Everybody who is hungry should eat, because Pesach must be consumed as a group. By definition, we're responsible for each other as individuals. Okay. Every individual who needs us should come and spend Pesach with us. That's not the hungry person. That's just feeding. That's the camaraderie. That's the sense of togetherness, of everybody's individuality coming together to celebrate the Pesach. Everybody should share their insights and as a result, enrich all of our perceptions. Okay. Hashatahacha the Shana Haba Be'arad Israel. Today we are here. Next year we should be in the land of Israel. That's a line for another day. Hashata Avde L'Shana Haba B'nei Chorin. We need to transform ourselves from those who are slaves of convention, slaves of social media, slaves of what everybody will say, and become ourselves. And next year we should be free, and then we can come together again and have Pesach. But it's the individual's contribution which in fact, everybody's individual contribution creates the whole. All right. That's so much for matzah. One of the remarkable things that marked Rabbi Yonaroni Neuwirth was the fact that he was a person who really was free. He was a person who, whereas he had tremendous and deep and abiding connections with people, he was a person of all incredible sincerity. You know, I'm a cynic, or I have a tendency to cynicism. And when I see people being overly emotional or overly expressive, I have a tendency to say, he's overdoing it. You know, a guy goes around hugging everybody. You wonder. However, at the same time, when about a year and a half ago, I was invited by Rabbi Neuwirth to be scholar in residence in Caesarea, something I love to do. I love to be invited to various shuls and to speak and to teach. And when Friday night, he came into shul, he hugged all the men in shul. And you knew that he was being totally sincere. He just loved people. He was who he was. He wasn't self-conscious. He just did what he thought, what he knew, what he felt that he needed to do. And he needed to express his love of people. And that was something really remarkable. He wasn't dependent in that regard. He wasn't trying to curry favor. He simply was who he was, and the person she'ohev adam, a person who loved people. He was also a person of tremendous vision. He was not dependent on the naysayers. He didn't worry about the naysayers. He saw what needed to be done, and for him, it was already built. It was incredible. He saw that there was a need for an organization of profoundly devoted rabbis and rabbaniyot to build a vision of Judaism in the state of Israel, that was different, that was welcoming, that was open to listening, and to really, really listening to what the community needed and wants. And the community is not the religious community. It was the entire Jewish state desired and needed. And he said it, and he created it. He created Rabbanei Beit Hillel, or Igun Beit Hillel, for that person, for a purpose, because he saw it needed to be done. And when and I remember meeting with him the first time and discussing it. And what was striking is the fact that he knew that. I mean, he was, even before he had set it up, it already existed. It was as if, you know, he just, all he had to do was fill in the pattern and fill in the blanks, and it would already be there. He envisioned a thing called Shabbat Yisraelit, where religious and traditional and secular Jews would have Shabbat together because they have to be together. It was even before it happened, and it happened. He talked about it as if it were already in the past, because it was so obvious that it had to be. He was absolutely not dependent, not on the dvash, not on the beitzim, and not on the apple juice. By him, everything was straight. It was he led. He went before the camp as a pillar of fire, because he knew to go. He knew how to go the way. I remember he was telling me what he wanted to achieve in Caesarea and Caesarea, it didn't work out, but he knew exactly what needed to be done. He was always right. Once he had his vision, he knew to enlist other people to create the whole, which is greater than the sum of its parts. And that was Beit Hillel, and that was his move with Tzohar to build communities, communal rabbinate. And his plans were endless. His book, which I highly recommend, both in English and Hebrew. In Hebrew, it's called Gesher Halacha Hatzar, and in English, the Narrow Halachic Bridge. The English one I actually had the privilege of writing an endorsement of, Haskama. He already had a vision of where Judaism and the state of Israel should go, and what kind of, and how it should be presented, and how it should be marketed in the good sense, made available, made accessible to people. He was Lechem Oni, which becomes Lechem Geula in the strong, in the most profound sense. And I have to come back to that original interpretation. His energy was boundless. It was not to be believed. He just kept going and going and going and going and going. And that was really remarkable. Just like the person who ingested the matzah and just keeps going and going. Not because he's enslaved to anybody, but because he's full of purpose and full of vision, and he walked going to redemption, and he's leading the pack. He's leading the pack. He embodied Lechem HaGeulah. And he will be terribly, terribly missed, because we need more people like that as much as humanly possible. And all of us who had the privilege of knowing him are just out of words to contemplate a world in which he is not. The lesson, however, yesterday's Daf Yomi, ironically or not ironically, says that you don't make a great mausolea for scholars or for the righteous, because their deeds, and rather their words, are their testimony. That's their monument. And the same thing is true, and this is definitely true of Rav Ronen, that those of you who know him or knew him are invited to continue his work and his vision and his, with it all, we have to try to get as much energy as we can to imitate him in that regard. And those of you who didn't are really invited to read his book and to get a sense of who he is and to adapt whatever you can to make sure that that is his monument. It's a sort of a mixed Chol HaMoed, but Moedim L'Simcha, Chagim U'Zmanim L'Sason, and we will be back to Perkei Avot on next Monday at 1 o'clock.